Greetings again. Welcome back to our discussion of theological dialogue. And I'm grateful that you have chosen to download and listen to these podcasts. Please feel free to send me questions. If you have any questions along the way about the things we've been talking about, the difficulty of not being able to be together doing these, of course, is that I'm not able to look into your face and see a puzzled look on your face and then try to answer the question I think you're asking. So if you have any of those puzzled looks while we're talking along this way, feel free to send me an email or stop by and visit me in my office, and we can talk about these things in greater detail. We are in the midst of a discussion of the eternal state, the final subject of eschatology, which is the discussion or the doctrines of last things. And we're talking about the eternal state now of the righteous, the eternal state of those who in this life were drawn by the Spirit of God to faith in Jesus Christ, persevered in that faith unto the end, were raised from the dead, set to the side, to the right side of Christ in the judgment by virtue of his atoning work for them. And now enter into a state of bliss. What we're talking about is heaven, okay? We're talking about the state of the righteous in heaven. And as we talk about the eternal state in heaven, we're talking about the eternal state of the righteous, whereby the consummation of God's eternal decree is fully realized. Everything that God had purposed to do from before the foundation of the world is now realized. The glorification of the Son, the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, is complete in and through all things. And the elect are joined to the triune God in a relationship of perfect harmony, glorified to enjoy his creation as the creatures they were originally intended to be. Now, when I'm talking about this, of course, I'm talking about the reality that heaven is a state and a place, a condition and a place. Now, I made a big deal about that in our last session because it isn't just about some state of being, but it's also about a place of being. As I said, it is a place that the elect enjoy as the creatures they were originally intended to be. And I don't think there's any way for us as humans to enjoy the created world without it being a physical place for us to occupy. It doesn't make any sense, right? We must understand that it is physical because we are physical creatures. We are created in the image of God, first physically, thus we must occupy a physical space. So what I want to do in this session then, as we bring this subject to a close, is to talk about this physical place a bit more in a bit more detail. Remember, we are created as physical creatures. We were formed from the dust of the ground first and became living beings when God breathed his life into us, his imago Dei into us. So the natural question then becomes, okay, what is this physical place going to be like? That would be my question. It's a question that people have asked for a very long time. What is this place going to be like? If it is a physical abode, it's spoken of as a physical place, it has physicality, time and space continue to exist, albeit in glorified form, but nonetheless, we're still going to be creatures in a physical world. What does that physical world look like? Okay? What does it look like to us as we consider the idea of a physical place? Okay. So let's talk about this physical place. And we'll start by talking about the passing of the present world and the appearance of a new creation. The passing of the present world and the appearance of a new creation. A couple of different passages that I would have you look at. In Revelation 21:1, it says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more." And when you compare that to 2 Peter chapter 3, when Peter says in verse 13, but according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. We must come to the conclusion that the world as we know it will pass away and a new heavens and a new earth will come. All right, what exactly does that mean? Now, there's two different ways of looking at that idea. A new heavens and a new earth coming as the old earth passes away. Some Lutherans and fundamentalists argue from 2 Peter 3, all of verses 7 to 13, that this new creation that is being spoken of here is a whole new creation. In other words, they would argue from these passages and others that God is going to take fire to this universe and destroy the entirety of it and then reform all of creation ex nihilo. Their argument is that this world, all of it, has been corrupted by sin. Every aspect of the physical world around us has been corrupted by sin. When God cursed the ground because of Adam's sin, the result was that that corruption spread out throughout the whole world, such that the whole world and everything in it, and all the universe, even beyond this planet, has been corrupted by the fall. And so, they would argue, it must be destroyed. Sin must be wiped out completely and utterly in order for this new earth for us to occupy to come into existence. Okay, now, that seems to be a reasonable idea if you compare that to the reality of the human condition itself. Sin, all of sin must be destroyed. The devil must be done away with, cast away. The reprobate must be cast away. And everything related to the reprobate and the devil and sin and temptation, etc., must be done away with. And since it permeates everything, it seems reasonable that everything would be destroyed. So there are many who see it in that way. However, the problem with that is this. That seems to imply that this world cannot be redeemed. As I said in the last session, Romans 8, Paul speaks of the redemption of the created world, this world that we're living in. And he's speaking about the creation groaning under the weight of sin in anticipation of the day when it is redeemed. That language loses some of its value if the creation is groaning, waiting for its destruction in order for a new heavens and a new earth to come. Paul is using the idea of the creation groaning under sin as a metaphor for the fact that human beings are groaning under sin, waiting for the redemption of their bodies. If the idea is that God is simply going to wipe out the entirety of this creation, drive it into non-existence, and then recreate a new one, ex nihilo, that doesn't line up with what he does with us. Doesn't line up with what he does with us. Because he doesn't do that to me, or to you, or to any other elect person. What does he do? He redeems them. He takes out their heart of stone and gives them a heart of flesh. He sanctifies them to their day of glory. But he doesn't make them something else by blinking them out of existence and then recreating them from scratch. No, rather, he keeps that part of them that is immortal, the regenerated nature that the Spirit of God has put in them, that goes off beyond death into the presence of God. But he reforms that part of them that is fleshly and sinful in the resurrection. And so Reformed theology doesn't see this new heavens and new earth as the destruction, the complete annihilation of this planet and the whole universe, but rather simply a cleansing action of creation. Cleansing it with fire to burn off that which is sinful, redeeming the original, just like he does with us. Just like he does with the elect. Just like he does with those who regenerates. Yes, there will come fire, and yes, there will be a burning away of that which is sinful, but not the utter destruction of that. Fire is often, you remember from Scripture, seen as a purifying agent. You purify gold by putting it in heat and burning off the dross. And that's what God, Reformed theology argues God is going to do when it comes to the creation. He's going to burn off the dross of creation and redeem that which he has formed. Again, if God called all of this that we're living in good, because when he first created it, it was perfect in his sight, then for him to utterly destroy it, to build something new, is to say, well, no, it isn't very good. Yes, it was tainted by sin, therefore it has to be destroyed. See, Reformed theology would argue that the new heavens and the new earth are simply a cleansed version of this universe. That God takes this universe, the universe that we're in, he cleanses it perfectly to restore it beyond what even Adam experienced, glorifies it, if you will, and then seats us as physical creatures in it to enjoy it forever. In other words, the elements of this universe that are untouched by sin remain, and all that God declared to be very good in Genesis 1:31 remains. Just as there is continuity and discontinuity in resurrection, we believe that there is continuity and discontinuity in the new heavens and the new earth. There will be a new heavens and a new earth, but they will be a continuation, a cleansed version of the current state. Even time itself will be cleansed. Now, I have no idea how that's going to happen, but somehow God, even in time and space and the various physical laws and all that have been corrupted by sin, will be cleansed of that corruption by God. He will not have to speak it all into existence again, but rather will cleanse it. He will redeem it as the creation groans waiting for its redemption. Okay, so it will be, so the eternal state of heaven begins with a new heavens and a new earth. Once the judgment is complete, then God will cleanse the world, the universe of sin, and the elect will occupy it. But the second thing is the establishment of the eternal kingdom of Christ. The book of Revelation speaks of this. I know Jesus himself speaks of the kingdom of God and the kingdom of heaven, speaks of his own kingdom many times in his own writings. The apostles often speak of the kingdom of Christ. We see it very profoundly in Revelation 5, Revelation 19, Revelation 22. And what we come that to understand that to mean is the banishment of everything contrary to the will of Jesus. As the one who has been given authority over all things in heaven and on earth. Remember, he said that himself in the Great Commission, Matthew 28:18. He has been given all authority. He has become the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and every knee bows before him, and every nation falls under his rule. Thus, at this point, as the eternal state of the righteous begins, he has an eternal kingdom established. Everything is banished contrary to his will. The reprobate, the devil and his demons, and every aspect of creation that is contrary to the perfect will of God, he banishes it all and establishes his kingdom. He becomes the ruler over the eternal state. Make no mistake about it. The ruler of heaven will be Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ will be the king who will sit and rule over his eternal kingdom established on the new heavens and the new earth. Now, one part of that that is difficult for us to understand is that the elect will rule with him over various aspects of his kingdom. Revelation chapter 5 and verse 10, it speaks of this. Let me pull that up. Revelation 5:10. And you have made them, that is, those who are slain, the ransomed people of God. You have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. Somehow, in some way, the elect, those who are a part of this great kingdom that Christ is establishing, will rule and reign over various aspects of it. Now, what we don't know, and it's very, very difficult for us to surmise, is exactly what that means. How will this rule of the elect extend? We don't really know. But what we can know is this. If the reign of Christ is a reign of righteousness, of absolute holiness and perfection, then it stands to reason in a perfect state where all sin has been eliminated that we too will rule in righteousness. In other words, it will not be the kind of rule that has dominated this world, where by virtue of sin, individuals stand up and proclaim certain things to be their own and make dictates and establish draconian measures of whatever they want to do because they have power to do so. No, it will not be that kind of thing. It will be a unselfish rule, a righteous rule, a rule of perfection and glory, and a rule that will glorify this Christ. More than anything else, the rule of the elect will be a rule over the various things that God has created, that Christ is now reigning over, in order to glorify Him in some way. I am convinced that when the New Testament speaks of the righteous ruling over the earth, I think this is simply, in my opinion, I think this is simply the righteous now fulfilling, finally, the creation mandate of Genesis 1:28. Finally and forevermore, human beings will take dominion over everything in the world. And they will do so in a way that honors and glorifies the Creator and Redeemer. Now, I can't even possibly imagine what it would be like for us as human beings to rule over all that God has created. Maybe it will mean first that we will now have the ability to use all that God has created in this world to glorious ends. We'll talk more about this in a minute. But it might also mean that we finally are able to live in a world that doesn't dominate us, where we are actually able to control the circumstances of reality around us, which are so much out of our control in this life now, all because of the effect of sin. Again, I don't know what this rule is going to look like, and I don't know exactly how we're going to relate to each other in terms of this rule, where someone might have rule over me in some part of the new heavens and the new earth. But if that is the case, if that is what God has ordained, if that's what Christ establishes, then His rule over me will be one that I will love. It will be a glorious rule. It will be a rule in which I will find no jealousy and no consternation over the fact that someone has rule over me. It will be a perfect rule. Now, again, as I said, try to imagine being a fish, understanding the idea of living on land and breathing air is so very much beyond our comprehension. This is another example of something beyond our comprehension. But yet, it's very reasonable to assume that when Christ establishes His kingdom and makes us co-rulers with Him, co-regents with Him, that our rule will be in righteousness just as His is. Okay, so the eternal state begins with the new heavens and the new earth. There will be a new creation, or a cleansed creation is a better way to say it, the establishment of the eternal kingdom of Christ. But then in Revelation 21, we're told about the coming down of the new Jerusalem. Now, this has been one of those things that has been debated by so many about what that exactly means. There are those who take a very literal approach to Scripture, of course, who believe that this is a literal city coming down from the heavens to the new earth, and its size, its dimensions are listed there, and what it's made out of and so forth are all there. It's the capital city of the people of God on the new earth. A city that's 2,200 kilometers in size, height, width, and depth. But it's the place where Christ rules, literally, over the people of the world. It's the capital city. But it also has a metaphorical perspective. So there are many who take it in a literal sense, and it could very well be. And I don't deny the possibility that there will be a literal Jerusalem, a city, a great city, 2,200 kilometers high, 2,200 kilometers across, that will be basically the central hub of humanity. But there's a metaphorical sense to it as well. And the metaphorical sense could be that this is the central hub of the life of the people of God. Think about the capital of Israel, Jerusalem. Think about what that was intended to be. When David took that city and made it his capital city, when he completed the conquest of Israel and established his capital in the city of Jerusalem and built himself a house there, a palace in that place, And then asked God if he could build a temple there. Remember? Jerusalem became the center of Israelite life. It became the center of all of its social, ethnic, and religious identity. The people of God came to this place because it's where the temple was. It's where they came into relationship with their Creator. It's the place that they came for their laws, and their ethnicities were established there. It's a place where the records were kept. It's where the king lived. It's where the laws were written and distributed, and on and on and on. Right? Became the center of the life of Israel. It's the place where relationship with God could be found. Now, it's interesting to note that in this city, according to Revelation 21:22, there's no temple. There's no temple because the whole city is the tabernacle of God. Now, metaphorically, I think what that means is that this is a place where God, or more specifically, the person of Jesus Christ, the ruler establishing his kingdom, as I mentioned before, is where he will rule from. And there will be no need for a temple or a tabernacle or an altar or any of those kinds of things, because there will be no need for a mediator. The mediator is seated there in that place as both God and man, the God-man forever. And when we come to Jerusalem, we're able to come right into the presence of this Jesus. We're able to come right into the presence of God without any mediator. There's no need for a temple. We can walk right into the New Jerusalem. We can walk right into his throne room. We can walk right up to his throne, and we can bow down before him and worship him and love him, and he will love us. This is the picture, I think, that's being painted metaphorically of a place where, excuse me, God himself will reside. But we're also told in Revelation 22 that there are some other things about this New Jerusalem. First, there's a river of life. There's life-giving waters flowing from the throne of the Lamb himself. Revelation 22:1 talks about the river of life flowing out from before the throne of the Lamb, from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. A river of life. Now, the way to interpret that is to understand it as life-giving waters flowing from the throne of the Lamb himself, flowing directly from Christ to his people. Real life. Real life. You know, things like purpose and value and existence and need and so forth, all being fulfilled in him. Because what flows out of his throne is life-giving waters. It's that sense of refreshment. I mean, water for human beings is one of the most fundamental needs that we have. It's one of the most fundamental physical needs that we have. And so it could very well be that this life-giving water is literally water that we will need to survive. But it's more likely to be pictured as all of what life is about coming from this Christ, coming from this one seated on the throne, coming from this Jesus who is the one whose throne is established as a kingdom. The throne of David, established forever. So this life-giving water, to me anyways, probably represents much, much more than just sustenance. It represents all of value and purpose and existence that comes from Jesus himself. It comes from the one who has glorified us to purpose, coming from him. But we're also told in the second verse of Revelation 22 that there is a tree of life. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean just one singular tree. It means tree in terms of the tree of life. So imagine an apple tree. It could mean a whole orchard full of them, but it's a tree. A specific kind of tree is what it could be referring to, the tree of life. And if that sounds familiar, it should, because that's a reference certainly to Genesis chapter 2. The tree of life that was planted there in Eden, that Adam was permitted to eat from. And as he did, it was life-giving fruit. In this case, life-giving fruit growing alongside the river of life. All of the sustenance, quote-unquote, that we need in eternity. If the river of life is providing purpose, then the tree of life is providing the sustenance, the quote-unquote energy to go out and accomplish what we need. Now, I understand that the way this is painted physically. And again, I've talked about physicality here. The mention of these trees, along with the marriage supper in Revelation 19, does seem to imply the continuing physical nature of the elect requiring physical sustenance, requiring food, right? But it's hard to understand how food would work in creatures that are eternal. I mean, does that mean that if we stop eating, we die? No, it couldn't possibly mean that because we are glorified creatures in which death is no more. So it's obvious that food will not be necessary for the existence of, as sustenance for the existence of life. So it seems reasonable to assume that these forms of ingestion aren't just for the purpose of keeping us alive, but much more for the metaphorical purpose of giving our existence purpose and energy and all of the kinds of things that we will need. Let me put it this way. We're physical creatures. We eat in order to survive in this world. But in the next, we eat in order to have all of the enjoyment of life. It's interesting, isn't it, that food, even in this life, is often considered an enjoyment. We eat in order we eat not just for life, but we eat for enjoyment. You don't see people often eating alone in a restaurant. We like to sit with others and talk and enjoy life over a meal. It becomes sort of a center of activity, meaning, purpose, value. And I think that's what this is referring to in a sense. But even if it is for physical sustenance, it's coming from Christ. It's coming out from His throne, from the water flowing from His throne, and the life coming from His throne. Now, by the way, you will notice that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is nowhere mentioned in the book of Revelation. And the reason why is because that device used by God to bring about redemption in the world is no longer necessary. And so it's not planted in this particular garden, in this particular place. All right, so the eternal state of the righteous, this physical place, begins with the new heavens and the new earth making their appearance, the establishment of the eternal kingdom of Christ, the coming down of the new Jerusalem. But I think there's one more thing, and I think this is extremely important. And I'm going to include this only as my opinion, because where I'm going now, I think, is speculation. I am convinced, in my own opinion, that the new heavens and the new earth, with Christ ruling over it with His kingdom, the new Jerusalem coming down upon it as the abode of God in the midst of the people, becomes then the playground of the elect. The playground of the elect. Now, I must confess, I don't know if I got that phrase from my own imaginations or if I got it from a book called Heaven, written by Randy Alcorn and published in 2004. That particular book by Randy Alcorn, which is called Heaven, was very influential to me in my understanding of the concept of heaven. He makes some extremely lucid points about heaven, drawing on the scriptures and the descriptions of heaven that we have, and correlating that with the world in which we live now. And a lot of my own view of heaven was marked by that particular book. Now, I think Mr. Alcorn has a certain reformed tendency in his thinking. As you read through it, you will see much of that. Yet at the same time, I can't say that I agree with everything that he says. So like any other book that I would recommend, it is subject to interpretation through a biblical lens, and he is not writing an inspired book. It's not scripture, but it's useful. I think it was a useful book in helping me to understand. So I believe that this phrase, the playground of the elect, whether he coined it or I did, if he coined it, I give him credit for it, but I see it as the playground, that the new heavens and the new earth are the playground of the elect. Now, what do I mean by that? What do I mean by this is the place of the playground of the elect? Okay. When we look around at our physical universe, the physical universe in which we live, there's much about this universe that we do not know. There's much about this universe that's beyond our comprehension. There's much about this universe that we simply have no possibility of ever experiencing ourselves. I mean, think about it like this. There are billions of galaxies out there. We've now discovered through telescopes and other means that there are billions of galaxies out there. And each galaxy contains hundreds of millions of stars. And around those stars are likely to be planets, just like ours, floating around in space, orbiting suns. There are countless other kinds of objects out there, quasars and black holes and all kinds of things. The list is innumerable of all the kinds of things that are out there. And they're simply beyond our reach. They're simply beyond our comprehension. They're beyond our reach. I mean, if that's not the case, here we are in the early part of the 21st century, and it was, for all practical purposes, believed by early 20th century writers like Arthur C. Clarke that we would have this point, by 2020, be able to venture off beyond planet Earth to the other planets in our own solar system. I mean, getting to the moon was a massive undertaking, and now we're starting to make plans to go to Mars. But even getting to Mars is not twice as hard as getting to the moon. It's 1,000 times more difficult than getting to the moon because of the distances and because of the issues of space travel, etc. It is beyond our comprehension even to go to our closest neighbor, which is a tiny fraction across the entirety of this universe. I mean, the moon is further away than you can drive a typical car built, even with modern technology. 238,000 miles away is more than most cars will ever be able to drive. So to make a round trip to the moon of over almost 500,000 miles is impossible even in a modern vehicle. We are, the universe as we know it is beyond our comprehension. And even on this planet, there are places that we simply do not know anything about. The depths of the sea are as foreign to us as the other side of the moon is. We are beginning to explore those things, and technology has allowed us to go down and to view things down there that we would never imagine. But there are new creatures being discovered in the depths of the ocean every day that we have no idea, and they're in our own neighborhood. God created this universe with a massive creativity. An infinite creativity is probably a better way to say it. There is simply no way for us to understand the massiveness of this universe. And so when the new heavens and the new earth are formed, and when God cleanses this universe from sin and plants his people on a new earth, and he removes the deleterious effects of sin upon us such that our minds are able now to go beyond where they've ever gone, is it possible then that this universe, which we have never even begun to explore, becomes our playground? How much time will it take for human beings to fan out from this planet and visit all of the stars in this universe? To visit all the galaxies even in this universe? To go and visit and see some of the things that God has created in places outside of here that we can't even begin to fathom or imagine? Now, I'm not talking about other intelligent creatures, because if God, in fact, created this world and redeemed this people by his Son, that would imply that there are no other intelligent creatures. But that doesn't mean that there are not unintelligent creatures out there. What if there are other beings out there, creatures, animals and plants, for example, birds and fish and insects and whatever else we might discover in other classifications we can't even imagine? What if God has equipped this universe for us to explore, and it is in the eternal state that we are set about to explore it? I mean, are we not as creatures explorers by definition? Do we not come into this world as children, as explorers? Think about how much we like to explore. You think about children and how much they like to explore things. Sometimes getting themselves into trouble exploring things. I remember as a child exploring in places that I definitely should not have gone. But I just had to see. I was curious. Curiosity is a part of the Imago Dei. It's a part of what God has put into us, to go out and to explore what He has created with His infinite creativity. Imagine what would happen if the corrupting and limiting effects of sin were removed from us so that we are free to explore all of the infinite creativity of God in this created world. And on top of that, not only to explore the created world, but also to explore God Himself. Now, I don't mean as some sort of, you know, object that we, you know, fly through and try to figure out. No, I mean conversing with God. I have argued in my preaching from the book of James that speech is one of the most profound and significant elements of the Imago Dei. What if our speech, redeemed by God, allows us to converse with an infinite being, with minds that are capable of understanding things, and thus able to approach God and converse with Him from His infinite nature as God, and to learn, and to learn, and to learn, and to learn. Now, let me be clear about something. You'll notice that what I just said implies something. I am not at all convinced that we will suddenly become infinitely knowledgeable at the moment of our glorification. I don't believe that at all. We're human. We're not divine. There's only one being with all knowledge, and that is God. We will never be creatures of all knowledge. But we are designed to be learning creatures. That's what we're designed to be. And so upon our glorification, established in the new heavens and the new earth, with Christ taking up His abode here with us, will not our opportunity be for us to converse with this God and learn from this God, to walk and talk with God in the garden forevermore? Our worship of this God will be perfected as well, to be able to come into the presence of this God and to enjoy His majesty, to enjoy Him and His absolute perfect nature and His relationship, to be able to explore a relationship with God that the triune God possesses between the Father and the Son and the Spirit. Again, we'll never be infinite. We'll never be all-knowing. We will always be finite, time-bound, physical creatures. But even in our glorified state, we will continue to grow and learn and glorify God with each new thing He reveals to our hearts and minds. Taking the unique gifting that God has given to each of us, the unique gifting that God has given to each of us, removing the effects of sin from that gifting and turning us loose to explore that giftedness to glorify God in the created world. I don't have the ability to write music. I don't have the ability to even read music. I've tried to learn it. Hasn't been an important thing for me to try to do. So I have no giftedness when it comes to music, but there are people who do. There are people who are extraordinarily gifted when it comes to music. It's unfortunate that so many of them have rejected their Creator and will continue to be rebellious in hell forevermore, never being able to explore that giftedness that God gave them. It will become for them a torture because they had a giftedness. But what about the regenerate man? What about the born-again man, the glorified man who has an ability to write music? I can't even imagine what kind of musical instruments and musicality will be invented by people whose giftedness has all the effects of sin removed from it. Can you imagine that? I can't even imagine that, but that's what we are to imagine, I think. I am convinced that the playground of the elect is this world that God has given to us, and He removes all of the effects of sin upon every aspect of what it means to be human. And the net effect of that is a world of unimaginable creativity, unimaginable beauty, unimaginable exploration, unimaginable discovery, and most importantly, I think, unimaginable relationship with the one who created it all. Why did God decree to create a world? Why did God decree that sin would enter into that world, but his only begotten Son would come and redeem a people that would be drawn to him from that world, who would enjoin themselves to this Christ by faith? Why did he do that? Did he do it just so that we could be handed a harp and some wings and a little cloud and told to go and enjoy ourselves? No. No, I think he created this world in the anticipation of its redemption and glorification, along with the glorification of a people that he would bring to himself so that they would praise him eternally in this created space. In a created world. You see, what is now only imagination will then, I think, be allowed to flow into reality, flower into reality by using the imago Dei within us to create and explore everything God has made. Which, frankly, will take an eternity to do. Right? It's going to take an eternity for us to explore the infinite creativity of our God. The infinite creativity of his nature as God. So I think the new heavens and the new earth represents so much more than just us standing in line like a giant choir singing at the foot of the throne of Jesus for all eternity. I know there are some who kind of think like that. I think that God is going to be worshipped not just in us doing that. We will certainly do that, I do believe. But not just in us doing that. Us, as those who are born again of the Spirit of God, coming into the presence of this God and really knowing him. Really knowing him. Which is where I want to end this theological dialogue. Thank you to all of you who have participated in listening to it over the the last couple of years as I've been preaching this, teaching this. There's been a lot that we've discovered and discussed, and there's probably 1,000 more subjects we could discuss. We could take an entire lifetime. In fact, my point is we'll take an entire eternity to learn all of who God is. So I thank you for participating in this theology. And here's what I'm hoping that all of it has now consummated to do. That it's given to you, as you have spent some time with me on this journey, given to you the opportunity to think about the greatness of God in terms of all that he has purposed to do. What I really love about Reformed theology, what I came to understand about Reformed theology very quickly, is that this is a theology of decree. God has purpose. And that purpose isn't just to get us saved. That purpose is to do massively creative and wonderful things in his relationship to us as a people. What we've done in this theology class over 100 and some odd sessions is barely scratch the surface of who Yahweh is, who Jesus is, who the Spirit of the living God is. We've just barely scratched the surface of all of that. To understand the concepts of God and a cosmology around us, of the angels above us, and the creation below us, and then the effects of sin, and all of what God is doing in salvation to rescue a people to himself, the establishment of the church, and then the consummation of it all of that, I hope, has been a journey for you to help you to get a glimpse of who this God is in anticipation of spending an eternity before his throne, worshiping him. Frankly, I can't even begin to imagine what that day is going to be like. What a joy it will be when the scales finally fall from our eyes and we're able to look upon Jesus with unadulterated vision and see the beauty of this Jesus, to know his love for us, to really see it in his eyes as he looks at us, as he calls us to himself and says, "Well done, good and faithful servant." as we persevere to the end and stand firm in our faith in anticipation of that day when faith will be as sight. That's what we're looking forward to. That's what I'm looking forward to. I hope you are too. And I hope this study of theology has at least a little opened the door to a greater view of God. My prayer is always, as a pastor of the Church of Jesus Christ, my prayer is always that the people that I have the privilege of ministering to would come to know Jesus more and more and come to understand more and more of what this God has really done for us. Who is this Yahweh? Who is He? And what has He done? So my prayer as I wrap this theology, this theological dialogue, my prayer is simple, that through it all has been helpful to you to not only come to faith in this Christ, but to continue in faith in this Christ. May He and His Word by the Spirit of God have its way in our hearts and our minds, and may this series of theology have had value to you such that it gives you great hope and joy for what God will do in eternity. Again, if you have any questions, please feel free to send them to by email. I'm more than happy to continue the discussion, and I'm looking forward to a new topic down the road as we're able to gather together again. So we won't be doing anything now until we are able to regather on Wednesday nights in the future, but I hope that won't be too long from now. But I bid you Godspeed, and I pray that you will come to know this God more and more as you talk about Him, as you do theology. May God bless you. Thank you for joining me.